From NPR and WBUR, I'm Scott Tong in Washington, D.C. It's Here and Now. COVID cases and hospitalizations are climbing again in this country, and they are surging in South Africa, where there are two new subvariants of Omicron. And around the world, vaccinations are lagging. Last year, the World Health Organization wanted to get 70% of the world's population vaccinated by this June. It will miss that deadline. Let's check in on the progress, or lack thereof, in the global vaccination effort with Dr. Krishna Udayakumar. He's founding director of the Duke Global Health Innovation Center. Doctor, welcome.
Hi, Scott. Good to be with you.
So I wonder if you can take us back to this goal, vaccinating 7 out of 10 people around the world. It was an ambitious goal. What was the thinking then?
Sure, you're right. It is an ambitious goal, but it's one that's really necessary and built from a principle of equity. And we know that new variants can emerge from anywhere and threaten all of us. So it really is imperative for COVID that we're able to increase both vaccination coverage, but also now to make sure that we're protecting the most vulnerable through third doses or boosters as well.
We've, of course, are falling short of the WHO's goal. What are the main reasons why? Is it a matter of demand or supply or funding? What's going on?
The goal, as you said, was 70% of every country by the middle of this year. So far, with only 2 months to go, only 52 countries have reached that goal, according to a report recently from the World Bank and the World Health Organization. There was an interim goal that said 40% of the population of every country should be vaccinated by the end of 2021. Still now, 69 countries haven't reached that milestone. And 21 countries haven't even gotten to 10% coverage. So it's not like we're close and we're just going to miss it by a month or two. For the first year or so, really the challenge was supply. Mm-hmm. It was a feat of really great science that we were able to develop vaccines so quickly. And we should be really proud that over 11 billion doses of vaccine have been delivered. But there have been incredible inequities. If you look at low-income countries, they've on average gotten about 10% of administered doses relative to high-income countries. And now that the supply situation, largely on a global basis, has worked itself out and we have a surplus, what we're seeing now is an underinvestment in the distribution, the delivery systems, and demand generation to make sure that we can continue to turn vaccines into vaccinations.
So help us understand some of this infrastructure that is still critically needed that isn't there. Is it trucks and refrigeration facilities and storage facilities? Is it the people to drive or get the word out? Is it information so that people know that there are doses coming to their towns? What is missing?
Yeah, I'd put them maybe broadly into three categories. The first is really political will. The second really is financing. So we are tens of billions of dollars behind on the money that's needed, not just at the global level, but at the national and local levels to roll out all of the things that are needed. And then the third thing is operational, the supply chain, the data systems, the people to vaccinate, the surveillance to make sure that we're able to monitor what's happening over time. The COVID-19 Global Vaccine Delivery Partnership is targeting the 34 countries that are in greatest need, that are the furthest behind. And it's difficult because the challenges are not the same across every country.
Is there a perception or a reality in parts of Africa that COVID actually hasn't been as deadly, as scary, as serious as we'd anticipated, and perhaps that is part of the reason for this complacency?
That is right. What we're seeing with more data coming through is that the exposure to COVID is likely much, much higher than is publicly reported across the continent of Africa. We have estimates if you look at seroprevalence, so the ability to see who's been exposed previously, that it may be as much as 800 million people across the continent of Africa that have been infected with COVID over the last couple of years. It may well be that the deaths caused by COVID are much higher than has been reported as well. And we've seen this around the world. If you look at the global number, we have about 6.2 million deaths which have been reported, which on its own is horrific. But if you look at the models, it's more likely that we're looking at 18 to 20 million deaths overall. So there is some perception about the role of COVID in Africa, but there's also the reality that the countries are trying to figure out how they balance competing priorities, that if we had all the resources that are needed, shouldn't really be competing priorities. And we should really also think about how not just to respond to an emergency, but how we shift this to a sustainable program over time that deals with the emergency right now with COVID, but that every dollar that's invested also helps to build the health systems of the future.
What are the risks to all of us of not reaching this goal of 7 out of 10 people around the world?
First and foremost, there's an enormous health and humanitarian challenge. We will be losing lives unnecessarily around the world. Secondly, our own health will not be fully protected. We should expect new variants to emerge. And we've really seen waves of COVID every 4 to 6 months, and there's no reason to think that's going to stop. So unless we really reduce the rates of infection drastically around the world, it's much more likely that we're going to see new variants in the future that may be either more transmissible or less susceptible to the vaccines that currently are protecting us. And third, we're losing economic activity. Our economic recovery will not be as strong in the U.S. Our health will not be as protected in the U.S. if we don't do more to protect everyone else around the world.
Dr. Krishna Udayakumar is founding director of the Duke Global Health Innovation Center. Dr. Udayakumar, thank you very much.
Thank you.
The Biden administration plans to end a pandemic border restriction. It's known as Title 42. It is scheduled to end in 3 weeks, but that's now in question. Now, officially, Title 42 is not an immigration policy. It's a public health order meant to stop COVID, not migration, at the southern border. But you might not guess that from the debate in Washington. NPR's Joel Rose reports.
In hearings on Capitol Hill, lawmaker after lawmaker blasted the Biden administration's plan to lift Title 42, the policy that allows immigration authorities to quickly expel migrants at the border on public health grounds without letting them ask for asylum.
The situation at our southern border is an unmitigated disaster, and I fear it's about to get a whole lot worse.
Removing Title 42 is wrong, reckless, and plain stupid.
And it wasn't just Republicans like Representatives Steve Chabot of Ohio and Burgess Owens of Utah, but a handful of Democrats as well, including Representative Greg Stanton of Arizona.
It's clear to me that the federal government is not prepared, not even close.
For 2 years, the Trump and Biden administrations have insisted that Title 42 is a public health order, while critics complained that it's really a border management tool in disguise. Even supporters of Title 42 now mostly agree. The debate that's playing out in Congress and in the courts is openly about whether Title 42 is an effective way to manage migration. And that argument is far from settled.
Title 42 is a policy failure, plain and simple.
Representative Pramila Jayapal of Washington and other progressive Democrats held a press conference outside the Capitol this week, urging the Biden administration to follow through on its plan to end Title 42 on May 23rd, as the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has ordered. Immigrant advocates say Title 42 has not deterred migrants from coming to the border. In fact, they point out it has removed any penalties for crossing more than once. Tyler Moran is a former advisor to President Biden and co-founder of a nonprofit called the Immigration Hub.
What we've seen since Title 42 has been in place is a huge increase in the number of people who are making multiple attempts to cross the border. And the overall number of people attempting to cross the border since Trump put it in place has only increased.
Title 42 was in place when the Border Patrol set a record for apprehensions last year as migrants flee poverty, violence, and corruption across Central America and beyond. Hundreds of thousands of migrants have been expelled to Mexico, where many have been victims of kidnapping and other crimes. The Department of Homeland Security says lifting Title 42 will likely lead to another spike in border apprehensions. Republicans have seized on that prediction. Here's Representative Mike Johnson of Louisiana.
We'll be totally overwhelmed. We'll be crushed by the sheer numbers and the weight of illegal immigration. And there will no longer be any border, any security here, any sovereignty at all. We won't have a country.
Republicans accused Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas, without evidence, of deliberately encouraging illegal immigration. This week, Mayorkas released a detailed plan to deal with an increase in migrants if Title 42 is lifted, relying on the immigration laws that were on the books before the pandemic. And Mayorkas pointed out that migrants have a right to seek asylum under U.S. immigration laws.
My family are beneficiaries of those laws. We fled the communist takeover of Cuba to enjoy the freedoms and liberties and the democracy that makes this country shine. And we are intensely proud of our humanitarian relief programs.
For now, the Biden administration is still planning to lift Title 42 in less than a month. But a federal judge in Louisiana issued a temporary restraining order this week, blocking the administration from beginning to phase out Title 42, which means it could still be in place at the border for a long time to come. Joel Rose, NPR News, Washington.
Many of us remember 30 years ago when violence erupted across Los Angeles. That's after four white police officers were acquitted in the beating of Rodney King, a black man.
It was 3 hours after the verdicts were read that the troubles began some 30 miles away on the south side of Los Angeles. At the intersection of Florence and Normandy, at least two persons were pulled from their vehicles and beaten in the street. One of them, truck driver.
The uprising went on for days, killing more than 50 people and causing about $1 billion in damages. Eventually, the National Guard came in to settle things down. In his podcast, Slow Burn, host Joel Anderson takes a detailed look at the events leading up to the violence. Here and Now's Tanya Mosley spoke to Anderson in January about what he found.
You know, Joel, it's hard to believe the story of Rodney King and the riots were 30 years ago. What made you want to dive in deeper now?
Well, I mean, I think it really goes back to the third season of Slow Burn, which I also hosted. In the second episode, we cover how law enforcement all around the country, but particularly in Los Angeles and South Central, ramped up these like really aggressive police tactics against black and brown communities. And out of that, you know, that new style of policing, that new style of aggressive policing came the explosion and birth of so-called gangster rap, you know, the NWAs, the Ice Cubes, all that sort of people. And so as I'm in the middle of that podcast, the third season of Slow Burn, which is about the lives and deaths of Biggie and Tupac, I'm like, man, that is a really fascinating era. And so that's where the birth of this story comes from. And I know that like Slow Burn tells stories about the events of yesterday that tell us a lot about what's happening today, right? And there's absolutely an element of that. We're going through the so-called racial reckoning following the George Floyd incident. And it has some real resonance, but in truth, I'd been thinking about telling the story for a couple years now, not even trying to time it up with the 30th anniversary or anything. It's just something that I really wanted to do.
Yeah. I mean, this is interesting what you're saying here, because we often look at, especially when we listen to Slow Burn, it gives us a lens into where we are today. And in LA, poverty levels in South LA are worse than they were 20 years ago. There are continual investigations about conduct within the LAPD. In a lot of ways, what we're seeing mirrors 1992 in so many ways. What did the LA riots reveal to you about these larger issues within police systems?
Well, yeah, I mean, they're sort of an outgrowth of a lot of the broader societal problems we see. You know, you've got in South Central LA in the late 80s and early 90s, we're in the middle of a crippling recession. And in fact, in 1991, California, the state, lost 333,000 jobs, like in that 1 year. Well, two-thirds of those jobs are in LA County, and disproportionately are reflected in losses in those black and brown communities. So all these good jobs have slowly left the area. The area steadily becomes more impoverished. What was once a working class, middle class neighborhood becomes a poor urban one. And then you've got all the problems that sort of come with that, you know, drugs, violence, gangs, all that other sort of stuff. It's really concentrated. Then the police respond, right? Also, sometimes with the tacit approval of community leaders, people that want to see their streets safe or whatever, or think that they're, you know, the best way to deal with it is to ramp up policing and to lock up people. And so you kind of have that dynamic going on and on. And like, this is not, I mean, what I'm describing to you is something that is happening today, happened 30 years before that, and sort of was the pretext for the 1965 Watts riots. And so one thing that you learn is that like, none of these things are just a coincidence. It's not just
mere happenstance. Incidents.
Yeah, they're all things that feed into that, that fuel these incidents long before you see the explosions play out on national television.
One other thing that you explore is Rodney King. You take the time to humanize him. You know, back in the early 90s, he was widely ridiculed after his beating by police. What is one thing that you learned about Rodney King that surprised you?
I think there's a couple of things. One, as I got started on this, I realized I just did not know a lot about Rodney King. As you mentioned, I thought of him as a joke. I thought of him as a punchline. You know, I'm looking at the guy and he's just like, oh man, this is really unfortunate. He seems really pitiful. But then you investigate and you look into the story, and I read his autobiography. And, you know, so there was a lot of push and pull after the video came out, right? That there were people in the community and people that had been working on anti-police violence efforts in LA that were like, this is the moment. We've been talking about LAPD and what they've been doing to us for decades. We didn't have proof. Now we've got proof. Here's the guy, Rodney King, right? And on the other side is Rodney King's mother, who was a Jehovah's Witness. And as part of that, you know, Jehovah's Witnesses, and if you're a Jehovah's Witness and I get this wrong, please, you can write in and correct me. But my understanding is that they are against political statement and that you should not make public political stances. And so when Rodney King is trying to sort out, you know, in this, I mean, he's just beaten almost to within an inch of his life. He has brain damage and he's trying to figure out what happened here and saying, I think they may have called me a racial slur. I don't know. His mother says, no, don't talk about that. I don't want you to bring that up, because if you do, that'll just make it a controversy and so on and so forth. And so he listened to his mother early on. And I didn't realize, you know, people were very disappointed in Rodney King that he didn't show up for protests or he didn't speak out against police violence then or after, right? And a lot of that came from how he was raised and his mother. You know, there was a very powerful incentive for him to just do what he had been raised to do and taught to do, which is respect his mother and not speak up in that moment. And it could also be that, you know, just frankly, that Rodney King was just incapable of articulating the broader issues that led him to that moment.
Folks will have to listen to the podcast to hear how that happened. But I'm curious from you, how did the media's reporting contribute to this dehumanization of Rodney King? What are some lessons the media can learn from Rodney King on covering these kinds of incidents? And I'm thinking about our modern day coverage of cases where Black men are killed or harmed by police.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think there's a couple of things at play. I mean, obviously the media could do a better job of not turning a victim into the defendant, right? And I mean, some of this is because those were the only public records that were available about Rodney King. He was not a guy like any particular distinction. He was a high school dropout who had had difficulty finding work. And the only thing that anybody knew of him is that he had been arrested and put in jail for, he'd robbed a convenience store with, I mean, it's sort of a goofy crime. It wasn't a violent crime, right? But that's what people knew of him, right? And so, in the absence of a victim that can speak for themselves, it would just be useful for people to remember that they are not, that the victims of these beatings are the victim of the shootings, right? Because now, you know, the videos we see, there are people that don't survive the incidents of police violence. And so humanizing them and thinking about how did they end up in that situation and the people that are attacking them or harming them, like, I would like to see more written about them and investigating, you know, does this department have a pattern and practice of abuse or police involved shootings or whatever. Like, that's the sort of stuff that I think would be more useful to humanize the victims rather than focusing on whether or not did they get arrested before? Could they have possibly have brought this on themselves? That was sort of one of the things that was missing. But that's, I mean, it's understandable how it happened, but it doesn't mean that we have to keep doing it, right?
One other thing that we're reflecting on and also examining is our language and the use of it. For instance, the word riot has come up as a word that we're interrogating at this time. Now that you've uncovered some of the systemic issues that contributed to the violence in LA back in 1992, is the term riot the best description of what happened?
I don't know that there is one all-encompassing term that gets the job done, because there are elements of what happened in those days in 1992 that are riots. There are people that are just looking for an opportunity to hurt people and take things. It's not wrong to say that it was a riot in some ways, that people went out to the streets and did things that they shouldn't have done. But that also doesn't mean that there wasn't a reason for that as well. Like, there were people that were doing things that were clearly wrong, but they were also motivated in some part by the right reasons. And so I just think that people have to sort of take a nuanced look at it. Riots is just a shorthand, but we can investigate and interrogate that beyond that and figure out like the individual motivations and the individual factors that led to LA catching on fire.
You know, with every story that I touch, and especially stories like this, where you get deep into it as a journalist, you're an investigative journalist for all intents and purposes. What do you want people to take away from the podcast?
I want people to know that for us to get the sort of police reform that we want, it's going to take something different than what we've already done. And in 1992, there was some momentum. They're like, okay, clearly there's been some injustice here. We should do some things to course correct and get more control around the police department. But ultimately it devolved into, oh, we should build more businesses in these communities and give more opportunity. And they should do that. But that fundamentally is not what we were talking about. We were talking about whether or not LAPD should police Black and Brown communities in the same way that they police white affluent communities. And that's not something that they do. So more broadly, I just think that what I want people to take away is that if you think that police reform is important, and if you think that the policing that happens and this disproportionate police violence against Black and Brown people in this country is a problem, we're going to have to do something more than sort of nibble at the edges. It's going to have to be a fundamental rethinking of the relationship they have with those communities. But the issue is always, is there the willpower to get it done?
Joel Anderson is the host of Slate's Slow Burn podcast. Joel, thank you so much.
Tanya, thanks for having me on. It's a pleasure.
Sri Lanka is facing a deep economic crisis. The pandemic and policy decisions have led to skyrocketing prices and shortages of medical supplies and fuel. But also to blame is the U.S. dollar. Wei-Lin Wang and Adrian Ma of our daily economics podcast, The Indicator, explain why.
It was during the pandemic that Sri Lanka's problems really started to snowball. The economy shrank 3.6% in 2020, and a big part of that was the disappearance of tourism, which brings in billions of dollars every year.
Sri Lanka's local currency is the rupee. And so when American tourists arrive on the island for vacation, they swap their U.S. dollars for rupees. And their dollars then flow through the Sri Lankan banking system.
Now, a government needs foreign reserves for all kinds of transactions. We'll talk about two big ones. Number one, pay off foreign debt.
Let's just say that I want to borrow money on the international market. Well, getting into the game really requires you to have U.S. dollars. So when I issue bonds to try to raise money, I issue those bonds in dollars. But that also means I have to make interest payments on those bonds in dollars.
But the country had a problem. More dollars flow out of Sri Lanka than come in. And this perpetual shortfall meant the country was always going in search of more dollars, especially when it came to keeping up with debt payments.
Yeah, basically having to get new debt to pay old debt.
And then this treadmill of taking on new debt to pay off older debt, it was mostly fine before the pandemic. But then credit ratings agencies downgraded Sri Lanka. They were concerned the country was too risky to be a good borrower.
Sri Lanka lost its access to international markets and couldn't sell any more bonds. A key source of foreign exchange, which it needed for debt payments, was now gone.
Sri Lanka started draining its reserves, and this created another problem. Because the second big way that governments use their foreign exchange is to pay for imports, all the stuff they buy from the rest of the world.
To try and keep its foreign reserves from getting so depleted, the Sri Lankan government started restricting imports of certain goods, like wine, mobile phones, and furniture.
Chayu Damsingha is an economist at a research firm in Colombo.
Chayu says before the crisis, Sri Lanka would have enough reserves to cover maybe 6 months of imports. Now it's around a month or less. The decline in reserves has been basically a vertical drop.
There was a cooking gas shipment that required a $5 million payment that couldn't be cleared and the ship had to be sent back. So which is a ridiculously small amount not to be able to pay. Sri Lanka is, we should not have come to this level.
Sri Lanka stopped foreign debt payments. This is the first time in the country's history as an independent nation that it's done that. The pause is helping free up scarce foreign reserves to pay for critical imports like fuel and even medical supplies. In the meantime, the country is getting short-term credit lines from India and aid from the World Bank. It's also in talks with the International Monetary Fund about a loan package.
Adrian Ma,
Weilin Wong, NPR News.
Let's explore a 160-year-old medical mystery. The Battle of Shiloh, 1862, was a turning point in the Civil War for the Union Army. And out of that battle rose a legend. Some Confederate and Union soldiers reported that their wounds glowed. Angel's glow, as they called it, helped them to heal more quickly. That's what they said. Well, a high school science project may have solved the mystery of the glow. Here's the story told by WBUR's podcast Endless Thread, hosted by Ben Brock Johnson and Amory Sievertson. They begin with a researcher and her high school-aged son.
Phyllis Martin. I'm a retired USDA Department of Agriculture. I worked in insect biocontrol for 32 years.
Insect biocontrol?
It's controlling insects without the use of chemicals. What I actually did was control insects using bacteria. I started out in Bacillus thuringiensis, which basically it kills gypsy moss.
This is wild stuff. You're talking about using bacteria to
kill insects. It's essentially, I'm trying to cause a pandemic among insects.
This is like the coolest thing I've heard about in weeks, and I'm very excited to learn.
It is.
We are excited to learn because, yes, all of this does have something to do with the Battle of Shiloh and Angel's Glow. So one day, Phyllis's son, Bill, comes home. He has to do a science project. He's not that psyched about it, but his project partner, Jonathan, is into it.
You know, it was one of those things that, hey, if I've got to do it, let's make it interesting.
One way to make the science project interesting was to get some help from Phyllis, who had access to a lab and a new bacteria she had just started working with called Photorhabdis luminescens, which, as you might imagine from the name, is a bacteria that glows. Really, the bacteria creates the glowing stuff just by living its life. It's one of the byproducts of the bacteria's existence.
Photorhabdis luminescens is a bacteria that is associated with nematodes. So it doesn't really live in soil per se, but it lives in a nematode in the soil.
And that's like a nematode, for lack of a better description, is a worm.
Yeah, a little worm.
And Phyllis was working on this bacteria that lived inside of nematode worms and had bioluminescence, similar to other animals, certain kinds of deep sea creatures, plankton, and
fireflies.
Has glowing bacteria been around us for a long time and we just haven't noticed it? Or is this really a very special thing?
They've been around for a long time. You'd have to be around, you know, where they are. Like, the Photorhabdis bacteria are associated with nematodes, and some of the nematodes are associated with plant pathogens.
So one day, Phyllis comes home, and she's talking about her work with this nematode-inhabiting glowing bacteria. And Bill perks up.
We're talking about bacteria at the, you know, at the dinner table, and he would say, "Mom, what about this glowing wounds? You know, what could cause that?" His dad is a scientist, too, so, you know, we talk about these things at the dinner table.
Phyllis, Bill, and Bill's science project partner, Jonathan, all thought it could have to do with Photorhabdis luminescens, but they had to try and prove it.
And that was going to be no small task.
First of all, they were trying to answer a question about something that had happened a century and a half ago. They also couldn't get soil from the battlefield to look for the right kinds of nematodes because there were restrictions about taking soil across state lines. So instead, the kids set about recreating the right conditions in Phyllis's lab.
Bill and his partner Jonathan's first discovery, Photorhabdus luminescens, doesn't grow at human body temperature, which, not a great sign. But then...
they went and looked at what happened at Shiloh. What made Shiloh different? Well, Shiloh was in the spring. It was cool. It was wet. Aha! People were laying on the field for a long period of time. So they took an infrared thermometer and went outside and pulled up their pants and took a look at what the temperature on their exposed limbs were. They found out that extremities, okay, it's not in the torso. The torso, even if you exposed your torso, it really didn't cool down very quickly. But, you know, legs and arms, you know, if you expose them to cool outside temperatures, would definitely be a temperature that the bacteria could grow on.
Wow.
Okay. All right.
There was no way we could really conclusively prove it, but it's like, okay, we need to show that it was possible. Nematodes don't like body heat, but if you go out in the spring, does your extremities get down to a temperature where they can live for a little bit? And it's like, everything is working.
So nematodes like the cold. Remember what else Phyllis told us nematodes like? Plants.
One of the plants that these nematodes affect are peaches. And Shiloh had a peach orchard, which had very heavy fighting.
The Shiloh battleground was covered in peach trees. More validation that Bill and his partner Jonathan were really onto something here. Back to the lab.
So now we got the bacteria growing. Okay, but can these bacteria prevent organisms that cause infection from growing? So they looked at the organisms that would cause infections in Civil War wounds. Okay, basically gangrene. I said, you're not working with gangrene. But Bacillus, you know, is a spore former, like Clostridium.
Okay, sure, okay, sure, obviously.
We use it as a safe, as a surrogate for that.
Jonathan and Bill found that Photorhabdus luminescens did inhibit infection from bad kinds of bacteria. They also found hints that its byproducts might create antibiotics.
So why might the bacteria have gathered around soldiers' wounds? They found a possible explanation for this, too. Photorhabdus luminescens was the best at killing off other bacteria when it was around blood, maybe drawing some strength from the blood itself. Well, this is glowing vampire bacteria.
Glowing vampire bacteria. Well, yeah.
Bill says he never expected their crazy hypothesis to bear out.
You have all specific, like, checklist of all the criteria it has to meet. And you're running down through it and just be like, oh, it's going to fail at some point. And then it just never did.
So, quick recap. Bill and Jonathan, with Phyllis's lab lending and guidance, proved that a luminescent bacteria commonly found in tiny worms that are themselves commonly found in peach orchards, like the ones at Shiloh, could live on the surface of skin.
As long as it was cold enough. It can also fight infection, especially when it's close to blood, and maybe, just maybe, could play a role in creating antibiotics.
All of this for a high school science project. All thanks to Bill hearing a battlefield legend and connecting the details to his mom's work at the USDA.
He must have been pumped, like he couldn't have dreamed up a better science fair project.
He could not.
Bill, Jonathan, and Phyllis had something. Pretty quickly, they were flown to Pittsburgh by Siemens for a science competition, which they won. Then they went on to be a winning team at the Intel Science Fair, which, if you're on the science fair circuit, it's one of the big ones.
You can find references to Angel's Glow and Bill and Jonathan's project all over the internet. One of the interesting things about this story is how it's almost a story about folding time. It took modern-day science to fully discover the thing that happened, but it never would have been discovered in the first place if it had happened in modern day.
Surgeons in the Civil War didn't know about bacteria and disease. If they did, soldiers might have wrapped their open wounds. And at the same time, today, we might never have observed bacteria like this. For one thing, we live in a world full of light pollution.
My memory is that to even see the glow for ourselves. We were like sitting in a closet for 10 minutes waiting for our eyes to adjust, just to see it with the door closed in total blackness.
The soldiers at the Battle of Shiloh experienced something they couldn't explain. And here we are, explaining something we'll likely never experience. So in that sense, maybe the legend of Angel's Glow lives on.
We'll never know for sure if we have the answer. But there's also a potential evolution for this legend. According to Bill and Phyllis, a lot of antibiotics aren't as effective as they used to be because bacteria are becoming resistant to them. So could bacteria itself, like Photorhabdus luminescens, be part of an alternative?
We don't really know. Yet. Maybe someday, someone will do a science project.
That's Amory Sievertson and Ben Brock-Johnson doing their homework on the podcast Endless Thread. The Magic Kingdom could use a sprinkle of pixie dust. Disney finds itself in a feud with Ron DeSantis, the Republican governor of Florida. The company criticized a new law that restricts teaching on gender identity and sexual orientation, at which point DeSantis and his allies voted to take away Disney's special tax status in the state. Now, there is a bigger cultural push and pull going on here, according to Derek Thompson, staff writer at The Atlantic, and he joins us by Skype. Hey, Derek.
Hello, good to be here.
So you see this feud as a product of cultural angst on both sides of the political divide. So let's take one side at a time. One of these unstoppable forces, as you argue, is conservatives moving state politics to the right across the country. How so?
That's exactly right. I do think that Republicans are moving state politics to the right. I think they are doing so in part out of a fear of cultural disempowerment. If you poll Republicans, you find that there's basically a total collapse of institutional trust in colleges, in big companies, in the entertainment industry, in tech firms. And that as a result, I think Republican voters are more accepting of their leaders using illiberal means to pull politics to the right. So what are some good examples? Well, look at Governor Abbott in Texas using a law that essentially deputizes citizens to sue, say, Uber drivers who drive women to a clinic to get an abortion. Or look at Florida, where Governor DeSantis is explicitly punishing Disney for speech in order to demonstrate, I think, his conservative bona fides. I think this is a very interesting development.
And this is a change on the right, is it not? We used to have what they called country club Republicans aligned with big business, at least in Washington and state capitals.
I think it's probably a change among parts of the right. I do think you're right that to a certain extent, I think you're correct to a certain extent that there are elements of the Republican Party that has historically been libertarian. And a libertarian would not want to pass an overly vague law. They would want to pass a law that was really, really narrowly targeted so that the state wasn't overreaching in its power. I would argue, however, that the law that was passed by the Florida legislature and signed by Governor Ron DeSantis, both that limited the kind of speech that can legally happen, kind of instruction that can legally happen in Florida high schools, and then punished Disney, I think both of those were kind of anti-libertarian laws. They were sort of examples of extraordinary state power. Power, I should say, that was a kind of response to what a lot of conservatives see as extraordinary liberal meddling through corporations. That's what they think this whole Disney's involvement in this fracas was all about.
All right, and let's talk about the other side, the liberals. And you cite liberal millennials, which is how you label yourself in this piece, moving big corporations like Disney to the left. What do you mean?
I think there's no question that whether you're conservative, liberal, or centrist, you have to acknowledge that liberal professionals have become activists about being anti-conservative. You look at an organization like the NBA, which responded to a conservative law in North Carolina by pulling their business out of the state. You look at major tech companies that hail causes like Black Lives Matter, whose positions on subjects like policing are clearly to the left of the typical American. Now, you could say that their attitude toward policing is moral. You could say their attitude toward policing doesn't work. But it is clearly to the left of the typical American. And I think that, you know, one thing that's happening here is that just as Republicans fear cultural disempowerment, I think a lot of Democrats and liberals fear political disempowerment. They see that Republicans are really, really strong at the state level, really, really strong in the courts. And as a result, they're using corporations as kind of like their proxy army in a national political struggle. And again, you know, I what I'm trying to do in this piece is not so much say who is right and who is wrong. I'm trying to see things as they exist. And it's just interesting to me that, you know, to sum it all up, to a certain extent, there are Republicans who I think are freaked out by cultural disempowerment and they're yanking politics to the right. But there are Democrats who are freaked out by what they see as political disempowerment and they're pulling their institutions to the left. And so this is sort of the whirling gyre in which our cultural war is spinning.
And these corporations, these big businesses, I mean, some analysts think that because they want to hire these urban millennials, they want to sell their products to these urban millennials, they really have to pay attention. That's a bit of their constituency, yeah?
I would absolutely agree that to the extent that you are, you know, defending the managers at these companies and saying this is why they're listening to their, you know, liberal millennial activists, this is why. It's because they're trying to hire people that are college educated. Guess what demographic in the United States is most pro capital D Democratic Party in the US? It's people who graduated from college. So if you're trying to hire a college educated people, especially in dense urban cities where liberals tend to live, then you do need to be very interested in, very concerned about, you know, how young millennials, how young liberal millennials think about the world. And I think that's one reason why you're seeing corporations be more involved in political discussions than they used to be maybe 5, 10, 15 years ago.
Yeah. And quickly, are we going to have you back, say, during the midterms or 2024 presidential race for another one of these battles, do you predict?
I think that for better or worse, and here I would definitely say it's for worse, words about words about words, cultural war politics is taking over politics. And as a result, I would imagine that more fights about words are going to be at the center of the midterms as well.
Okay, Derek Townsend of The Atlantic, thank you.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Scott Tong in Washington, D.C. It's Here and Now. Thank you.